All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another News and Focus podcast. In our Sunday morning sermon, Bill, even as I was preaching, this verse jumped out at me. It really wasn't the focus of the message at all, but it did come out. It comes to us from Numbers chapter 14, verse 34. Give the listener who's not familiar with Numbers 13 and 14, give them for a moment 30 seconds of a layout or a summary of what these two chapters are about.
All right. Well, the children of Israel are in the wilderness of Sinai, I believe. They are close to Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea is on the south border of what is now Palestine, or I should say slightly removed. But in any case, the 12 spies, one from each tribe, are sent for 40 days into the land of Canaan to basically do a recon and to see about the people and the bounty of the land and to see how they would best conquer the land. They came back and gave a report to the leaders, the elders, presumably, of the children of Israel, and talked to them about how 10 of them gave an evil report about how they were grasshoppers in their sight. Some of you might remember that. And two, Joshua and Caleb gave a report that basically, let's just go down there and stomp their guts. We've got this. God gave us the land. Let's go. And basically towards the end of the chapter where we're going to get to today, God says that because of their disobedience, the people of Israel as a whole, because of their disobedience and unbelief, they would spend 40 years wandering, a year for a day, of the recon.
Now, we really have quite a dynamic going on in 14, Bill. And the reason I say that is because Moses appeals to God for a pardon, and God grants them a pardon.
Yeah.
He grants them, he says, okay, I'll pardon them. And yet they still spend 40 years wandering in a wilderness and die. Their carcasses die. And so we've got this little contrast going on here, which God says, yes, I'll pardon them. However, except for Joshua and Caleb, they're all still going to die in the wilderness. And that kind of leads us, Joey, to verse 34, where you get this description of how long they're going to be there and why. And after the number of days in which you search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, you shall bear your iniquities even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. Now, those words just jumped off the page at me.
Sure.
Had you seen that before, Joey, or was Sunday the first time you'd seen that?
I think Sunday was the first time I noticed it.
I'm sure you've read the chapter before. There's no doubt, Old Testament survey, you've read the chapter before. But just because you read something doesn't necessarily mean it jumps off the page. But Sunday morning, during the sermon, I could not believe what I read. I was just in shock. I could not. Why are we in shock? What's the issue here?
Well, I take a beeline for John 3:16, and I wonder if he'll breach that promise. Yeah, I make a beeline for Romans 10:9, and wonder if he'll breach that promise. Philippians 4:19, will he breach that promise? So, you know, the second, third order effects are, if he'll breach a particular promise in a particular context, why would he not do it in every context if given the right circumstances?
I mean, we are staunch believers in the eternal security of the believer. Staunch.
Certainly.
I mean, we don't waver in that area in any way, shape, or form. We don't have any exception clauses.
And to make it even maybe perhaps a little steeper for the listener is the fact that we're eternally secure since before the world was formed. So you have all of a sudden an eternal decree that can be annulled.
The word breach is pretty clear.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a promise that's been broken.
Yeah, my mind went to Third ID breaching the berm, you know, in 2003 when, you know, you and I were over there in 2003. I just think of God just cutting right through a promise and not fulfilling it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem.
Sure.
And it is especially a problem to a particular group of Baptists. Who are those Baptists that's a special problem to, Bill?
Do you mean a negative from a negative aspect, or I would see where it would be a problem for particular Baptists. I would see where it would be a problem to Sovereign Grace type Baptists. I would see where it would be something to consider in a favorable manner for Free Will Baptists, General Baptists, to think that God could change his mind about a person's salvation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the group that comes to my mind, Joey, is King James only folks.
Oh, okay, sure, you're going there.
Well, yeah. I'm saying because, I mean, me, I'm going to go look at the Hebrew.
Of course.
And I'm going to say, did these guys get it right? But if my presupposition, Bill, is that they got it right every single time, that, I mean, they were infallible in the translation, that God preserved his words in English in the King James, now what?
Right. Yeah.
Where do you go from there? I mean, I know where I went. I went to my iPad.
Sure.
I went to my ESV. I went to blueletterbible.org. I wanted to see, what's the Hebrew behind here? Is there any other references? Did they translate it the same way consistently? I went to the Hebrew.
Certainly.
What do you do, though, Bill, if you don't believe that that's necessary? Because they got it right.
Well, you avoid it. I mean, you don't preach word for word through Numbers. You don't preach verse by verse through Numbers. You just don't do it because it's uncomfortable. You have to explain things.
I don't know how you. I don't know. See, I have a real hard time understanding how someone would explain this.
Yeah, it really goes against our theology. God does not break promises. Period. He does. I am the Lord. I do not change.
I change not.
Yeah, I change not. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, what are you going to do? All my promises are yay and yay, and what? No, they're not. No, they're not. We got an example right here in Numbers 14 where they're not. I mean, if this rendering, and that's what I'm referring to, if this translation is excellent and accurate and perfect, then we do have one particular case where the Word of God says God breaks His promises.
I'd like to bring up another point here, and that is this idea that the King James translators simply translated, and all the other versions express some sort of dynamic equivalence where they interpreted rather than translated. But the King James translators did a loyal word-for-word translation. Now, I'm not getting on the back of the King James translators here necessarily, as much as I am people who put more value on their work more than the translators themselves did. Because the fact is, they shall know my breach of promise is one Hebrew word.
One.
So when you realize that you had to take a Hebrew word and get my breach of promise from it.
Let's count that. My breach of promise. Four words.
Right.
Four words.
And if I know that, then I want to know, and by the way, you shall know is another Hebrew word. I want to know. If my breach of promise is one Hebrew word, I want to know how did the King James translators translate this in another area? And this Hebrew word is only used one other time, and it's not translated breach of promise. It's translated occasion in the King James Bible.
Now let's talk to our listener. There may be a listener out there that, Bill, that thinks, well, I haven't been to seminary. What am I going to do? What tool are you using right now that's letting you see that?
Well, I have a $4.99 app up on my iPad known as eSword, and okay. I bought it a year ago. But I don't have to use this. I could bring up
what
my free
app would you
Blue
use?
Letter.
You
know.
Well, I just have it up on Blue Letter Bible.
Yeah,
Blue Letter Bible.
Yeah.
BLB is what the icon mm-hmm. looks like, right?
Right.
Yes.
I have that as well. Yeah.
And it's a free app.
It's a free app. It's free. You can go on to from your computer at home, sitting on
a
your laptop.
A computer, an iPhone, an Android, an iPad. And what are you looking at, Joey, when you went through that process? Because I saw you looking at your phone. What were you doing? How'd that work?
Well, I went to my, you know, I opened it. I went to the, I went to Numbers 14, found that Numbers chapter number 14. Scrolled down. I looked at the verse. I read the verse, and then I clicked the actual verse number. When you click the verse number, it gives you all sorts of options. I clicked the C for concordance. Then I scrolled down to the word breach, and I clicked on breach. And then I was able to look at the different uses of the words and how it's translated other times. And then a little bit of commentary on the word itself.
This is what we used to use. We used to have a Strong's Concordance, and that thing was 12 inches by 12 inches and 6 inches high, and you'd be flipping page after page after page.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can just do it in a matter of seconds on our phone.
And I've got the app up now, and I just click on the lexicon, and it comes up, and it gives you the meaning. It means alienation. It means to seek enmity against. It means to rise up in hostility against. So clearly, if that's, you know, is it Roger's Thesaurus? I can't remember. If you're dealing with a particular word in the Old Testament and you have a uniform translation, there's really no issues. You can know that the translators had a methodology by which they sought to translate the word. Hasanias' lexicon. Anyways, you tap the lexicon there, and it tells you what the word means and all of its possible usages. It gives you an Arabic derivative to rise up hostility against someone. So, if that's what the word means, then a person might say, well, does the context allow for a usage variation? In other words, does the context allow for the inclusion of this word promise, to breach a promise? And the answer is, not without some interpretation. There has got to be some interpretive work, not merely translational. Because if it was translational, it would have simply been, you will know my opposition. You will know my alienation. You will know my enmity. You will know my hostility. But it's not what happened. And what I want the listener to hear first and foremost is that the King James translators did exercise some level of interpretation when they decided which translation to use of the several they could have used.
Yeah, and there was a reason why the King James Bible was not accepted until the latter part of the 17th century in the 1600s, because it was the Geneva Bible. The people didn't want a King's Bible because they weren't happy with the King. They wanted the Geneva Bible. So it wasn't even the most accepted version almost until the 1700s, when they were tired of all the wars and the battles and the riots, and they went, let's get back to a king, let's get to a monarchy, let's have absolute rule, and that's when they wanted the King's Bible, because they knew these guys that were translating the Bible were translating it for the king, so they were translating it to make
potential
the king
bias.
Look good. Yeah,
potential
bias,
right?
The king. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So
that doesn't mean that they didn't do a good job.
No.
The purpose of this podcast is not to bash the King James Bible, but I think it's critical to bring to the listener's attention, you've got a major theological problem here, Bill, if you say unequivocally, they got it right each and every time without any interpretation. They consistently were inspired to get it right. Because we've just identified a scenario whereby God broke a promise. And I'm not ready to go there theologically.
No. No, I mean, that would create a problem. And immediately I want to say, is there room for it in the Hebrew? And clearly, if the verse was translated, you'll bear your iniquities even 40 years and you'll know my hostility, this wouldn't even be a conversation.
Of course not. Because we know that they're seeing his enmity.
Sure.
His
hostility. Yeah.
Thank you. His displeasure.
Right.
His
alienation.
Anger.
Right.
I mean, when you're using words like your carcass is going to rot in the wilderness, those aren't kind words, okay? That's hot.
Yeah.
But what you have to interpret, Bill, in order to get this rendering, is that God made an individual and particular promise to each and every Israelite.
Sure.
As opposed to a promise to Abraham and to his seed.
Mm-hmm.
In a general sense, Joey, not a sense of... Because there were Israelites who died in Egypt. Joseph died in Egypt. Jacob died in Egypt. These men didn't see the promised land. So if we're going to render that this is a breach of promise, which is the rendering that we got here, then we have to find something previously that says that God promised each and every in this generation that they would see it. And we don't have that.
Right. And I think, the listener has got to understand that I come from a King James only background. Not only do I come from a King James only background, but I left a church that was King James only and went to a Bible college for a year because it was King James only-er. I wanted to be even more King James only. And then when that wasn't King James only enough at 19, I got my first Peter Ruckman books. So when I talk about King James onlyism, I have some clue what I'm talking about when I say that the two biggest surprises to my personal research were, number one, yes, the King James translators also had to make interpretations when they chose a word. And number two, the King James translators also had to exercise some level of textual criticism. They had to look at two opposing readings and pick one. And those were the two biggest surprises to me. In my research, I was presented basically with the story that Textus Receptus was given to Erasmus in the late 1400s and that he had no texts to choose between. All the 5,000 manuscripts he had access to, all 95% of them matched, and he just picked the body of the 95% that matched, and he made his Greek text. And there was very little for him to do in the area of the science of textual criticism. That's how it was presented to me. It was presented to me that they also make word-for-word translations. I don't have a vendetta against the King James Bible. I have three copies that I regularly use. They're all marked up like a roadmap. I use them, but I want the listener to understand, because I'm sure out of the 400 or 500 that'll listen, we're going to have someone that's angry by now. And I'm asking them just to do the research themselves. Put down D.A. Waite. Put down Jack Mormon, put down Peter Ruckman, put down someone from Murfreesboro, and just do some research and find out how much work Erasmus would have had to do what he did in the late 1400s, early 1500s with the Textus Receptus.
Yeah, and even that, I mean, Erasmus's Greek text that he put together is not necessarily the text behind the King James. I mean,
That implies that they didn't consider any translation work done before them.
Yeah, because there was a Byzantine text, and so it's not like that's what came after Erasmus.
Right, but that is one of the things that's told, is that the underlying Greek text, at the exclusion of all others, mm-hmm. to include previous English translations, was the Textus Receptus for the Greek, and that, you know, it's... But the problem is, it's just not honest. It's not honest.
But the TR evolved over time, is what I'm trying to say.
Sure, there were four versions of it.
And the King James translation that the King James translator used to translate their King James Bible was not the same one that they didn't use the same exact Greek text in 1732 when they came up with the last edition of the King James Bible.
Which was revised itself 14 times before our 1769 Oxford that we have on the tables in front of us.
And there were tons of mistakes in the original 1611.
Yeah, spelling errors, punctuation that they updated, and even some in
like female, male, it's supposed to be a he, and they called it a she, things like that.
Right.
So there were they had to go back and do lots of revisions.
Well, I mean, I'm here to declare on this podcast that this is a mistranslation.
Yeah, no modern translation translates it that way. And when you read it yesterday in church, I was looking for it in the ESV, and I couldn't find it. No, it wasn't there. And I was glad, because I didn't have a problem.
Now, Everett's version. Everyone loves Charles Spurgeon. I love Charles Spurgeon. You love Charles Spurgeon. You love Charles Spurgeon. Charles Spurgeon had a predecessor at the Metropolitan Tabernacle. His name is John Gill. John Gill comments on this verse, "God never makes any breach of promise. His covenant he will not break, nor alter what has gone out of his lips. Men break their promises and transgress the covenant they've made with him, but he never breaks his. This should rather be rendered, 'You will know my breach.' Experience a breach made upon them by him. Hostility." So we have a man that would be considered the prince of the prince of preachers, the predecessor of the prince of preachers, who is not King James only. And this is 100 years removed from the King James Bible we have in front of us. Not 240, 100 years removed from the 1769 King James Version, saying, "Hey, I'm sorry, they got it wrong here. There's a better way to say this."
Yeah, you have the issue is not with the word breach.
No.
The issue is the word
breach
of
promise. It's an inclusion. It's an interpretation.
And we would have to see a Hebrew word in this text that is rendered promise.
Right.
And we don't have that.
No.
Yeah, and that breach of promise almost goes against what he said before. He's going to pardon their iniquity. He's not going to break the promise. All right, Moses, I'm not going to break the promise because of the promise I made for it. So it's strange that now we get to verse number 34 and there's a promise being broken.
Well, if you have a scenario whereby, you know, God has made a promise to each and every Israelite that they should see the promised land, then what do you do with Moses? I mean, he didn't enter. He got the sea, but he didn't enter. And did he break it with him? Where does it stop?
Right.
And so this is clearly a problem in the KJV-only camp. It's not a problem in this church. It's not a problem because we're going to go right to the Hebrew and we're going to take a look at it. And then, Bill, the other rendering, because it's only found twice.
Right, Job 33 is the other one.
Job 33, and how do they render that?
They render in one word, occasion.
Now, just think about that. I want you to understand. You've got the listener needs to understand. You've got the exact same Hebrew word rendered occasion and breach of promise.
Yeah.
Those are so far apart that you must see, listener, that they're interpreting.
Yeah. Furthermore, and you pointed this out before, Pastor Sean, and it needs to be reset every time we talk, every time we breach the subject. We've got to make sure that we are mentioning and re-mentioning that they're not in lighted rooms with iPads. These men are not able to research. What did Louis say over in, you know, over in Oxford? You know, the two committees at Cambridge, the two committees at Westminster weren't able to say, how did Louis over in Oxford translate Numbers 14? That I don't even think they even thought that deep, that, oh, this Hebrew word is only used twice in the entire Old Testament.
How would they know that, Bill?
Holy cow.
How would they know that? In order to determine that, they would have to list every single Hebrew word, and then every single time it's used, have some kind of chalkboard or some mechanism of putting marks next to it.
Yeah, right. So there was no strong concordance for them, even.
Right.
Not
right.
Even Strong's. No lexicons to tell you the many ways it's used, right, as far as that's concerned. Now, I'm not saying they're idiots, and I'm not saying they didn't have study tools. I'm saying that, as Pastor Sean has stated before, they're not sitting under incandescent bulbs and with speed software where they're able to see, how did we do this last time?
And there's a good chance that it was a different team that was translating Numbers and a different team that was translating Job, and they were translating,
right, we know that,
several, yeah, months apart.
Six committees at three different, yeah, locations. And did they check one another's work? That's the word. The word is yes, that all six committees checked the other five committees' work, to include the committee that did the Apocrypha.
Well, just think about that. Just draw a comparison, listener, to the idea that you and I, look, I have preached through Numbers 13 and 14.
Sure.
Several times. I know that the congregation, when they heard it Sunday morning, that was not the first time they've heard that.
Right.
And yet, I'm telling you, that's the first time those words jumped off the page at me.
Yeah.
Or we would have already talked about this. We would have already had a blog or a posting or something already about this very idea. So even if they did review all their work, that doesn't mean that everything was jumping off the page, just like it did us.
No, they had long days. I mean, we know the project from the approval of King James I all the way until its conclusion in 1611 was about 8 years. About 8 years. Now, you take men on six committees, as many as 57, as few as 48 at a given time during that period, and you take 48 men at the most conservative, and you take them with their bad days, mom fussed at them, you know, talking about wifey fussed at them, the kids aren't healthy. You know, there's more, and on and on and on, and oh, I'm tired today, and that slipped my mind, and take the normal humanity and then put it back there 400 years ago, and you'll see there were hurdles.
So see, when I look at it, and I immediately go to a text comparison, which is what you did, right, Joey?
Yes, sir.
Right. And I see that no one else has rendered it that way. That's a problem.
Yeah, and we're not talking about liberal. Because that's the idea. Like, where I went to college, everybody else is liberal, and we're not, because we use King James. And so, I mean, when you look at the ESV, that's a conservative, word-for-word, literal translation. When I was in my textual criticism class at PCC, it said, if you have to use a modern version, you shouldn't use a modern version, but if you have to use one, use the ESV. And it does not translate it that way.
And this is not a textual issue either.
No, this is not. They're not looking at
it's
very,
not a Hebrew area.
No.
This is a verse among the versions that should and could read similar, but they simply don't.
Can you pull on your phone and let's see what other renderings are out there?
Well, I have the ESV up, and I have the New English Translation. And the New English Translation, which is a Dallas Theological Seminary work, says, according to the number of the days you have investigated this land, 40 days, one day for a year, you will suffer for your iniquities 40 years, and you will know what it means to thwart me.
The ASV, American Standard Version, says, and ye shall know my alienation.
You're going to feel my displeasure. You're going to know what it's like to have my back turned to you.
You're going to know what it's like to tick me off.
Right,
that's
right.
That's kind of the idea behind Thor.
Right. You're going to experience something that doesn't say he's breaching a promise.
No.
And so, this is one of the reasons why we hold to the belief that this is a good translation. That's all.
Sure.
It's just a good translation. I'm not even going to use the word best translation. And the reason I'm not using the word best translation is because I teach teenagers and I teach high school students. And I know how hard it is to read this English sometimes. And so we would admonish all listeners out there, check out a New American Standard Bible. Check out a ESV. We're not in the camp that says all Bibles are equal.
No.
No, there are some bad translations.
There are some translations that have some clear agendas.
Mm-hmm.
But the current mindset amongst independent fundamental Baptists is all translation committees are liberal. All translation committees are theologically liberal. And that is simply not true. Yeah, it's a real mischaracterization. It's really it's on par with something like all blacks are lazy, some ridiculous, absurd generalization that if a Christian said it, that is so stereotypical that it's prejudice in nature. And what we're saying is that's the case outside of our little independent Baptist
world. When I asked the question at college, why couldn't we just translate a new, make a modern translation from the Textus Receptus? And the response was, there's no one today that has the intelligence and the ability that those guys had back then.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, and that was because that's all you could say. Because obviously there's a lot more tools, there's a lot more
information. Well, that's because the school you went to doesn't subscribe to the double inspiration, right?
No, they don't subscribe.
They stop short of that.
Yeah, the Greek text behind the King James is inspired, but the King James itself is not inspired.
Right, and so based on that, then you have to appeal to the intellectual excellency of those men in comparison to the idiots alive today.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's
yeah,
true.
That's fair.
In spite of the fact that for the last 400 years, more manuscripts have been discovered. Those manuscripts have been organized beyond measure, more than anyone can even fathom. The depth of understanding of how many times is this word, where is it also rendered. You see where I'm going with all those kind of things?
You just lost someone. I promise you did, and you know exactly where it was when you talked about unearthing more manuscripts. What about the person that says, there's your problem. You think the Bible hasn't been revealed yet today to the church. It's been buried for 1,700 years, and now it's being uncovered on pottery and on old papyrus and archaeological digs all over the world. What do you say to that person?
Well, the reality is additional scrolls, manuscripts have been discovered. I mean, we cannot ignore the fact that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in the 20th century,
sure,
in the 1900s. And then when we did discover them, instead of it rocking our world, it did just the opposite. It reinforced our world. When we compared the Isaiah manuscripts that we already had to the Isaiah manuscripts that were inside these jars of clay, and we find that they're nearly identical with minimal variance, and that our very God has been preserving, as opposed to the idea that this is more information hurts.
And it was one author in Isaiah, basically, is what it confirmed.
As opposed to this theory of
all four. And there was the idea, too, that you didn't use the Masoretic text to translate, because it couldn't have been accurate. So they were using the Septuagint, the Latin Vulgate, to translate the Old Testament. Now everybody knows if you want a reliable translation of the Old Testament, use the Masoretic text, and the Dead Sea Scrolls confirm that. So in one way, it was good for the King James when the Masoretic text was discovered, because there were people saying that the Masoretic text wasn't the best text. But when we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were written 200-300 years before the time of Christ, it gave us that assurance that the Masoretic text is the best translation of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, and this is unequivocal, the manuscripts are more organized now than they've ever been. They're more categorized. You know, you as a committee that translates the Word of God through iPads and computers and tablets, you have access to stuff that those boys in the 1600s would have they couldn't imagine the level of access.
Yeah.
To immediately say, all right, how many times is this word found? And let's look at all the other instances and how were they rendered, and are we going to be consistent?
Yeah, to the credit of Jonathan Edwards, who studied 13 hours a day, I'm glad I don't have to study that long. I'm not saying I'm as brilliant as he was. No way, no way. But I am saying that I can... The Bill Sturm of the early 1700s that would have studied 13 hours doesn't have to study a fourth of that now. Now, I'm not talking about study to make things applicable. I'm talking about study to find information, to research information, to put information in a workable order, to discover it, to show it to the congregation. That doesn't take near the time that it would have 200 and 300 years ago because of the tools that we have at our fingertips. Well, it should make us more efficient.
Yeah, seven years ago, when I was taking Greek in college, and we had this long an Excel sheet where we had to parse every verb. We had to look it up. We had to look it up in the concordance. We had to find the ending. We had to look on the little chart that had find the ending and then make a translation. Then look. You don't even have to do that anymore. I mean, I would have loved to have Blue Letter Bible when I was taking Greek in college. I would have gotten a much better grade. It would have been a lot easier.
Well, even something like a Strong's Concordance.
Yeah.
A Strong's Concordance, you know, which is a 20th century idea. You know, A.A. Strong.
Right.
You know, they didn't have that. So our ability to immediately go, all right, how many times is this Hebrew word used, and where else is it rendered, and how is it rendered? That is. They may have never discovered it.
Right.
They may have never discovered it based on the amount of, because in essence, Bill, you have to start at Genesis in your Hebrew Bible and start reading.
Sure. Yes.
That's and right. Write down every word, and you're talking about two words out of thousands.
Right, it's only used twice. It's only used twice in all 39 books. It's only used twice.
Well, I know there's over 8,000 Hebrew words in the Hebrew dictionary in the Strong's Concordance and dictionary because I looked at it today and I was looking up a word that was H8034 or something like that. So there are over 8,000 words that we're dealing with. How would you like to catalog that as you're doing a translation? And then get everyone on the committee of like mind. All right, you're going to use my translation from the last time I used this word.
Well, think about our New Testament, Bill. We've brought this up before, but it doesn't hurt to reinforce it. How many different times is Mark rendered? Mark.
Yeah.
It's not even Mark every time. It's the same dude. It's clearly the same dude, and you can't even spell Mark the same way.
Right.
I mean, we have an M-A-R-K, we have an M-A-R-C-U-S. I mean, you can't even render it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're supposed to believe that that is divinely inspired.
Yeah.
That whether we call you Will or William or Bill, I mean, that each time that...
Well, it gets even to the level of indictments against modern translation committees where there's... I really think it's disingenuous to say that here the ASV drops the word Lord, so instead of Lord Jesus Christ, it's Jesus Christ. Obviously, the committee doesn't think Jesus Christ is Lord. Yeah, except in the other 700 places where they keep it. Where they keep Lord in the title, you know, obviously the committee doesn't have a problem with the deity of Jesus. That's not the issue. But there are entire books by Gail Riplinger, for example, that say there's charts of comparison. Obviously, this committee hated Jesus and the deity of Jesus. Well, never mind the fact that in some versions, they're actually stronger on the deity of Jesus, like John 1:18, where it calls him the only begotten God instead of the only begotten Son of God in the King James.
Yeah.
So it's so disingenuous, this whole idea. And then finally, I think we ought to just really look at the fruit. And I'm going to say finally from my perspective here in this rant, I think we ought to look at the fruit. The fruit is that I grew up in that, and I cannot believe how ignorant of certain doctrines I was to where they would be bombastic and critical of people who used an NIV, and I'm sure that's not a great version of the Bible, still in my opinion. But when a person understands 90% of their NIV, and I can only understand 60% of my King James Bible, that means I'm still outdone by 30%. And I just think that the listeners got to understand that when you put... No one reads 200-year-old English in any other book other than for literature class. So why are we holding ourselves to a standard when the whole point of the committee was to give the common man in the vulgar language his own copy of the Bible?
Yeah, that's what we seem to fail to remember, is that in 1600s, this translation was such that the common man could understand it.
Yeah.
That they didn't go out of their way to make this difficult. Their charge was to translate it in such a way that the common man could understand it. But the fact of the matter is, language has changed over 400 years.
It changes in 40 years.
Yeah, the scribes, when they were translating the Old Testament, they were copying the manuscript for manuscript. I was reading the other day for my Bible class. The scribes wanted to ensure that as they translated it, that they updated the language where the language needed to be updated. So they were updating the Hebrew where the Hebrew needed to be updated. So even as they're passing it down, they're updating a word where a word has changed so it makes sense to the person that's reading it.
And maybe we should point out that the Masoretes added the vowel markings. Mm-hmm. So up until the Masoretes of the 600s or so A.D.,
AD.
So 500 years at least after Jesus ascends to the right hand of the Father, there were no vowel markings to the reader, which is pretty problematic when you realize that there are many Hebrew words of different of the same consonant makeup, that have completely different vowel markings because they mean something different. And why? Why? Because the Masoretes said, I know these words look identical, but they're in different context, and context determines the meaning of that word. Yeah. And so they would add different vowel markings, which would make the pronunciation different, because they, I don't think they would have liked the English language, where you have meet, meet, and meet. M-E-E-T means to come together with someone. M-E-A-T is the stuff you should eat, instead of the vegetable problem. And then you have M-E-T-E of Matthew 7. With what measure you meet, it should be meted to you again. They would not have liked that at all, because they all sound alike.
Right. Three different words sounding exactly the same and spelling is everything.
So the Masoretes added vowel markings to words that looked alike so that they would sound different and so that the different meanings would be evident to the reader. And that wasn't even added until 500 years plus after the ascension of Jesus.
Yeah, this is an important discussion for someone out there that really needs to work through this. And we just want to challenge you from this text to help you realize that if you subscribe to the belief that the King James is perfect in all its renderings, you have a problem in this text. If you think, like we do, that it's an accurate word-for-word translation, then you do not have near the problem, because you have a Hebrew text to go back to, and the Hebrew text trumps the English text. The Hebrew text trumps the English text.
Did you feel nervous saying that? Any trepidation?
Yeah, because there's still some folks out there that are so, they want to know that every word is properly rendered.
Right.
But that's not been the case all throughout history, and now all of a sudden we want to superimpose that on 1611. That's not, I mean, you know what I mean? That's not what happened all through. That's what we've been trying to say. That's not what's been happening in history, so why all of a sudden do we think that it started happening in 1611?
Especially when we realize that most of our King James Bible has a lot of roots in William Tyndale's work.
Yeah.
That William Tyndale's fingerprints are all over this King James Bible, rendering it exactly the same. And so what do you do there? Was it 1611 when God was doing inspiring? Or was it before with William Tyndale? I mean, where does it stop or start? And that becomes very difficult. And they don't have an answer for that.
No.
So that's why you have to go with like what your school did, Joey, would say it's not the English, it's the actual, this is what's inspired. And then, but they were really, really super duper intelligent guys and trained in multiple languages and theologically sharp. Well, again, we want to ask ourselves, how did they become so theologically sharp when they came out of the Catholic Church?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the Catholic, yeah, depending on which era they were developed theologically, because, I mean, you still had the whole English Church of England swap, because not only was King James the first of England, he was the sixth of Scotland. You know, so you had the whole Mary Queen of Scots issue. I think she was a good Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so King James is her son, isn't that right?
Mm.
And so, you know, we have that whole back and forth. So England wasn't a very settled country anyways.
No, but my point is that none of these guys would be welcome in our pulpits.
No. Well, I thought it was funny when you mentioned H. Strong. That dude wouldn't be welcome in our pulpit. In the late 1900s, or late 1800s, the 1890s or so there, he was taking trips around and surveying fundamentalism, and he would not be considered of our stripe. He wouldn't be allowed. We'd be afraid of some of the things that he would say.
But that's a tool that's used exclusively.
It's a staple in King James-only churches.
Right. And he is.
Right.
Just like Spurgeon is. And Spurgeon also was not a King James only guy.
Just like the Congregationalist
Spurgeon corrected
Schofield.
The text.
A Schofield's a Congregationalist.
Right, not a Baptist.
No. No.
Right, and Congregational is coming out of the Church of England.
Right.
All kinds of Church of England baggage. And that's
the greatest contributor to the UUA is the Congregational Church, the United Unitarian Universalists of Boston. Their greatest contribution are Congregationalists.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you've got this scenario in which we've got all these translators that no doubt love the Lord, but they're Anglican.
Right.
I mean, they're Anglican, they're Catholic in their theology.
We need to stop just for a second and remember that the indictment against Westcott and Hort is that they're Anglican priests.
Mm-hmm. But all these dudes are Anglican.
All of them are Anglican. All of
Westcott and Hort, they were liberal Anglican priests who might have been dabbling in witchcraft and the occult, so they can't possibly be.
Well, you have to destroy their character, Joey,
in order to,
that's how you do it. You destroy who they are as individuals.
So somehow 58, 57 Anglicans is better than two Anglicans. We have to make sure that...
Yeah, and they're telling what these... We don't know what these guys were... These Anglican guys were involved in. We can't assume that they were all pure... we know that time period. Power was corrupt there in that time period.
And I guess the love of money wasn't the root of all evil back then? I mean, these men were on the payroll.
I mean, Tyndale had a guy that he thought he was his best buddy, and then he turns him in.
Sure. It happened.
Betrays him.
Betrays him.
He betrays him for the reward. The money... To kill Tyndale was unbelievable. Now think about that. This is the same church.
Same church.
This is the church that has got money to kill Tyndale because Tyndale's given the commoner a Bible.
Hmm.
And they don't want the commoner to have a Bible because if the commoner gets a Bible, now all of a sudden he has authority.
Yeah.
Because intelligence or knowledge is authority. So that... Therein lies. If you don't know your church history, you cannot properly evaluate this subject. I mean, that's just a fact.
Right. And if these men were dual inspirationists, they would never have gone past the Latin.
They're not dual inspirationists, because if they were dual inspirationists, they wouldn't have marginal notes.
Sure.
And they have marginal notes with alternative renderings all throughout the original 1611.
And they wouldn't have packed the Apocrypha into their translation.
Right, but the inspired translation of the day was Jerome's. The Latin Vulgate.
Right.
You know, I'm saying that in quotes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but it was the stuff.
Right. So they would never have done an English translation of the Latin Vulgate if they were the dual inspirationists of the day and thought that God had preserved his word for the Latin-speaking
people. But how many English Bibles were there before we got to the King James? I mean, I know there was
the Coverdale,
Geneva Bible.
Matthews.
Oh, yeah, there's four or five.
Pulpit Bible or something like that.
Right.
Matthews,
yeah.
Coverdale.
The Great Bible, they put on the pulpit. Yeah, there's several.
They could come in and read during the week.
Right, this is not the first thing, the Geneva Bible. This is not the first thing. People have this bizarre understanding that this is the first thing that's done in English. It's simply not the case. But again, how many churches... Is there any sense of church history taught? Not a lot. Let's just face it, not a lot. Most churches are light on history, light on theology, and they overdo application.
Sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's where we're at. And so thus, it's very easy for a preacher to get up there and say stupid things, and nobody in the congregation is educated enough to know otherwise. Let's face it. The Presbyterian Church does not have this problem. The Presbyterian Church does not have this problem. There are not Presbyterian KJV-only folks.
There's very, very, very few.
Right. Certainly not of the Ruckman stripe.
No, definitely not of the Ruckman stripe. No.
Right. They use it. They love it. You know, sure, yeah. Greenville, North Carolina, that's their Bible. But they don't hold to this double inspiration. You're not going to find a Presbyterian church where you walk in and there's a wooden statue of a 1611. That's only a Baptist thing, Joey. There's Methodists that use the King James. There's Presbyterians that use the King James. I'm not saying using the King James. I'm saying holding to this revered, let's bow down before the Bible kind of a scenario. It's not in the Presbyterian denomination. It's not there. And there's a reason for that. There's a greater level of education in those denominations. That's just a fact.
And there are smart people who go to these King James only churches. Doctors, lawyers, there's intelligent people that should know, should be able to think through the issue. You know what I mean? There are. We're not saying that everyone that goes to these Ruckman churches, they're not. We're not saying that they're not intelligent people. They're smart people in those churches.
Yes, but when you start showing something like there's so many references to Jesus in this translation and there's only 52 in this translation, when you start whipping out those facts, suddenly someone goes, oh wow, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
And if they don't do any more research, then that intelligent lawyer can easily be duped into believing exactly what Bill said. Oh, that's a liberal committee. You know, those guys, they're all pro-gay. And you link a few things together like that, and next thing you know, the lawyer who normally researches stuff is just going down the road.
Yeah, if I could recommend a small book by John Ankerberg, the Bible Version Debate. It's like 56 pages. And he takes a lot of the logic that King James people use to prove that the King James is the best translation and applies it to modern versions. And a lot of the modern versions come out ahead of the King James version. Like what Bill was saying. There's times when the King James translators make less of the deity of Christ, you know, by their translations.
But so, those books that are KJV only quote the isolated cases that are in their favor. I mean, I would love to hear a King James only guy explain this to me. Because I've heard the Numbers and, I mean, the Acts, Bill. Why do we have Easter? We got Passover translated 28 times. Why is it one time Easter and there's some great reason why, et cetera, et cetera? You know, that they got it right.
Right.
I would love to hear why this is a breach of promise.
Yeah, I mean it really changes your theology.
You got major problems if God broke his promise here. Because the logical question is, and it's a realistic question, why can't he do it again?
Yeah. I guess when I come upon a troubling translation, the first thing I want to know is, does it have to be translated this way? You know?
And the answer is no.
No.
There's no need to translate it this way. That this is a poor way of communicating what they're trying to communicate right now. You will know my displeasure. You will know my enmity. You will know my irritation. You will know my frustration. You will know my hostility. You will feel and experience the pain.
Mm-hmm. And these Anglicans weren't Calvinist.
No.
They were coming out of the Catholic Church where you could work for your salvation, where your salvation could be gained and lost.
Through a sacramental system.
So that certainly could be part of the reasons why they're able to translate it that way.
Or it's not a problem.
It's not a problem for them.
It's also not a problem if you're trying to substantiate a divine right of kings,
mm-hmm.
who can make an edict and then, you know, have his fingers crossed, so to speak.
Change his mind.
Yeah.
Right. But the God of the Old Testament can't do that, then.
No.
And if he does that, he ceases to be God because he's no longer perfect and holy.
I mean, that's why we want to emphasize to the listener that the gospel is a promise.
Yeah.
Well, those are our thoughts. We can't wait to see what you're going to comment, what you're going to add to the discussion in a meaningful, articulate way. And please, be bold enough to put your name down. Bill, I don't know what to do with these people that want to rip us to shreds on a comment. And some of you in the listening audience don't see them because they don't get posted. But if you've got enough nerve to correct us and get us straight, put your name down. My name is Sean Harris. I'm not hiding behind something in an anonymous way. So my email is pastoratbbc@gmail.com. I love the folks that comment anonymous, no email address, and then they want to rip it to shreds. Be bold.
So courageous.
Be courageous. Mm-hmm. If you have enough gumption to put a comment down, have the same amount to attach your name to it. Those are my thoughts. Thanks for listening.